And now, from our mile-high Denver, Colorado studios, we bring you Connie Shaw with Spirit in Action.
Hello, everyone. This is Connie Shaw, your host for Talks for Compelling People, where we interview leading lights and emerging figures in the fields of ethics, spirituality, wellness, and selfless service. Today's guest is Waris Faridi, herbalist, healer, inventor, and spiritual teacher from San Antonio, Texas. Waris, we're very happy to have you on the program today, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing you speak to us about your topic, the creation of the meditative mind. Now, before we explore your topic, I'd like for you to tell our listeners when and how you started meditating and what the results have been in your life.
Connie, when I was growing up in Pakistan, I got interested in theosophy, and they had a wonderful library with all kinds of books on meditation from all different traditions. And I had an opportunity to go through a lot of those. I also had a Sufi background, where early in life I was able to meet many Sufi teachers.
Oh.
Yes, and in fact, one teacher from one of the Sufi orders, it's called the Chishtiya Order, became a good friend of mine, and he even told me that the Sufi term for meditation was muraqiba. And the literal meaning for that word was, or for that term is, a mind that is ready for the unknown.
Oh.
And so I did some Sufi meditations, and I got a good knowledge about the constitution of the mind and the inner constitution of man through theosophy. And when I was a teenager, some teachers of what you call transcendental meditation came to Pakistan, and very early I got initiated into the transcendental meditation also.
Oh, I see. It about how many years ago was that?
Well, that would be early 70s.
I see. And what would you say the results have been in your life?
You know, different people have had different results with transcendental meditation. To me, actually, it was quite positive because I followed the instructions very religiously, very particularly. And about the eighth month of following that meditation, I had kind of a transformational experience during the meditation in which I had an experience of all kinds of fear actually physically leaving my body.
Oh, my. How fortunate.
Yes, that was a very amazing. And at that point, I decided that I had achieved what I had to achieve from transcendental meditation, and then started to pursue many other techniques that I had discovered later. One of them is a common meditation that almost anybody can do, which is called the Soham meditation.
Oh, yes. Can you please explain what that entails?
Yes, it's very simple. It's you just sit in a good posture with your spine straight, whether you're sitting on the floor or on a chair, and start to pay attention to your breathing.
Yes.
And the breath that's going inside, you hear that breath as making the sound so.
Yes.
And the breath that's going out, the exhaling breath, would be the sound hum. You would hear the sound hum.
Yes. Now, you're actually saying it or just hearing it?
No, you're just hearing it. You're
All
not
right.
saying it. You
All
just
right.
hear your inhaling as the sound so, and you're exhaling as the sound hum. And what you do is you just pay attention to the breath, and anytime the mind wanders even a little bit, you just come back to attention on the breath. You don't get involved in thoughts or thinking I'm not meditating and I shouldn't be meditating. As soon as you realize that you're not meditating or paying attention to your breathing, you just gently come back to your breathing. It's practice. As we do the meditation more and more, we'll realize that our mind is wandering less and less. And we'll also be training our mind to stay one-pointed.
Now, is there any rule of thumb, Juarez, as to the number of beats or seconds that should be ascribed to the inhale of the so and the exhale of the hum?
Not for this particular meditation. As far as breathing and the number of breath grows, that's a different discipline which would come under pranayama. And sometimes, you know, teachers have combined that with meditation or chanting. But essentially, it would come under the rules of pranayama and require some more extensive knowledge.
I understand. Now, in regard to the use of meditation to control the lower bodies or the lower self, can you speak to that?
Yes, well, actually, all meditative exercises are basically directed to that end, to slowly and slowly controlling the mind. If we can begin to make our mind one-pointed, it will give us depth to the mind.
And
what we practice in meditation, we also start to practice in our daily lives, and we'll realize that we can solve our problems better, we can understand things better, we can have greater depth in understanding, and that starts to improve the overall quality of our life.
So then you could say that meditation helps to develop concentration and focus and probably discernment as well. Is that right?
That's exactly right. But I would at this point try to discriminate a little bit between what I call a real meditation and meditative exercise. So far, we've been talking about meditative exercises. What a meditative exercise will do over a period of lifetime is that it will start to give greater and greater one-pointedness and depth to our mind. And combined with a life lived with a life of purity and, you know, following all the higher principles of a spiritual life, we will eventually bring the entire nature in control and bring a quality of quietness and meditation that permeates all our activities, not just, you know, a 20-minute session, but all our activities.
Well, then, let's go back a few beats and speak to this quality of purity and to the higher principles. Can you say a few words about what you mean by purity and the higher principles for our listeners who may not be familiar with meditation or the spiritual life?
Well, you know, it's a quality that all religious teachers, all spiritual disciplines, all mystical disciplines point to. It's you know, it's all that's good and noble and true in our life. It's cultivating that, living that, longing for that, reading about that, writing about that, becoming in tune with that, permeating our whole being with that. It's, you know, doing good to others, a life of service. Service now is a very powerful adjunct to a life of meditation. Service has a quality of purifying the lower natures also. And meditation combined with the life of service works very powerfully to bring a quality of harmony. Now, the ancients of India have used the word sattvic, which is just another word for a balance and harmony. And we bring a quality of harmony in our nature.
Can you speak a little more to the subject of service? I understand the aspect of a sattvic nature and purity, but when you mentioned service, I assume you're speaking of selfless service or, let's say, charitable projects that for which one is not paid. Could you say a little more about that, please?
Well, service, you know, another way of looking at service, it's love in action.
Yes.
It starts with our immediate surroundings. We always, anytime we are in relationship, we have an opportunity for service. Life is relationship, so the whole life is an opportunity for service. Anytime we direct our activity to goodness in our society, goodness practice in relationship to others, a life lived with love and care, all that is service. We can take a project, we can permeate our whole life with service, and we have great examples of that in this century. Mother Teresa was one of the highest examples of service, because she dedicated her whole life to the suffering of others, to relieving the suffering of others.
Does the average person have to do something as heroic as Mother Teresa's service, which was extremely demanding and time-consuming? Or how could a person expand the service beyond the home and family if they have very little experience in doing compassionate works in the world?
You know, a very great living teacher, Avatar Satya Sai Baba of India, has said that the only thing that is required for service is reasonable health and the intention to serve. That's all. One can start, for instance, from home, writing letters to prisoners about the benefits of purity and spiritual life. One can be a part of a local group that serves, for instance, serves the homeless, or serves, you know, the prison community, or works with children with drug problems. You know, wherever there is a need to bring about balance and harmony, one can just start with by giving a little bit of time. Basically, just the intention and the ability to devote a little bit of time is required. That's
now,
all.
And what do you mean by a little bit of time? For example, how many hours a week would you recommend that a person devote to initial service in the community?
Well, you know, it does depend on each person's capacity and circumstances they find in life.
Of course.
A mother that has many kids and lives with great devotion and in service to the kids as far as bringing about the best in them, she's also devoting her time to service. May not have so much time to give externally to the community. As a person who has more time, can, for instance, 3 or 4 hours a week, one can usually manage. But if one can start with even less, or even just an hour a week, and then raise it to whatever best works in their life.
I'm getting the impression, Juarez, from what you're saying, in regard to your topic, the creation of the meditative mind, that as one stills the mind through discipline over time, that one's capacity of compassion and ability to give generously to others increases along with the deepening of the mind, and as a consequence, there becomes a longing to serve in a wider venue. Would you say that that's true as far as being one of the ultimate benefits of meditation?
That's very true, because as the mind gains depth, a lot of things reveal themselves. We become more aware of our essential unity with life.
Yes.
And as we become aware of our essential unity with life, the feeling of service starts to come more naturally.
We feel connected with others, and we then become more aware of their needs, their suffering, their pain, and how we might be able to alleviate some of their suffering. Is that true?
That's very correct.
How have you found that you have been able to serve other people in your role as an emissary to the community when you are working in expos and various fairs and showing people the different properties of gems and minerals and talking about herbs and so on. Have you used those venues to talk with people about spirituality and meditation? And if so, would you say that that is a type of a service, just doing those types of interactions in an ad hoc way?
Well, you know, I did not consciously think of it in the beginning. It just got to be like that because as I started doing the shows and people would come and we would eventually start talking about some special subject, mm-hmm. and I would answer people's questions with great attention and great responsibility. And that happened, start to happen more and more often. And in responding in this way, a certain pattern was set up in which, you know, sometimes people would call me and I would always respond. And this quality of responding to people who are calling spiritually, if I have something to share, that I have always recognized that in me from the beginning, coming from traditions, you know, Eastern traditions where teachers devote very selflessly to the disciples or to those that come to seek, I was able to help people that come with asking questions or, let's say, ask about herbs or ask some questions about meditation. I found that a very good way to talk to people and help people.
In other words, in the course of life, as you have yourself shared with others, as your teachers have shared with you, you've found that more and more people have come to you and that you have simply expanded your role as a spiritual teacher and you've been willing to spend more time with individuals in a variety of settings.
That's exactly right.
In wrapping up our interview on the topic of the creation of the meditative mind, it sounds as if some of the general benefits that a typical spiritual aspirant might experience in the creation of the meditative mind through either techniques or a true and pure meditation over time would be that a person develops one-pointedness. They also gain depth in the mind and discernment. They develop a concentration that expands to other areas of their life. They are able to sense the needs of others and to respond through compassionate, selfless service. Is that correct? And are there any other aspects that you would like to reinforce in regard to the benefits of meditation?
Well, that's exactly correct. Just I'd like to add that As the mind becomes quieter, the hold of the, you know, what we call the separated self, sometimes we call it a strong ego, it lessens. And just that has a tremendous positive effect in our life. Because a strong ego can be a very great hindrance to living a happy life.
Would you say that the egoic mind or the strong ego is an aspect or is another term for the shadow self, the shadow side of the self? For the qualities that are character defects within us which must be overcome?
That's correct. You know, we can look at it this way, that what was needed in the, like, let's say, in the early stages of evolution, to assert oneself in, you know, in the world.
Yes.
It starts to become more of a hindrance as a person evolves in the path.
Yes. Some of those strategies are no longer appropriate.
That's correct.
That they have more to do with conflict rather than with cooperation.
That's correct.
I understand.
When a person becomes more aware on the path, and becomes more inclusive. Actually, you know, one way of looking at it is this, that many spiritual and esoteric traditions define higher and higher, you know, initiations or higher and higher level of consciousness as becoming more and more identified with the whole.
Yes. Yes. And in that regard, I'm thinking now of a famous quotation that in regard to spiritual practices and meditation, that hands that help are holier than lips that pray. So as we become more identified with the whole, our spiritual practices and processes and our spiritual actions ideally become part and parcel of our very nature and much less conceptual or theoretical. Would you agree with that statement? Or?
That's correct. That's correct. Because when a life that's in which service is also very dominant, our threefold nature, the body, motions, and mind,
mm-hmm.
becomes a conduit for spiritual energy.
Yes.
And that itself gives a strong impetus to progress on the spiritual path.
Yes. You know, someone told me recently that it's all very good and well when a person considers himself to be a spiritual aspirant, and he might have a monk-like nature, or he might even be a monk in the Himalayas assiduously meditating in his cave for several hours a day. But the test comes when the monk walks outside the cave and he sees that somebody has stolen his firewood and he flies into a rage, then immediately the benefit of the hours of meditation are dissipated, and he then realizes that all meditative and spiritual practices have to be applied to real-life daily situations if they're going to have any merit and legitimacy. Would you agree with that? Or
that's exactly correct. A life meditation has to be part of a life that in which the whole is geared towards living spiritually and living wholly.
So the meditation practices then have to be grounded or anchored in the world, and I gather that you would say in the world of service, that we're not meditating selfishly for ourselves, but that actually as we become more clarified, then the spiritual capacity empowers us to be able to help other people that are still perhaps moving in the fog of suffering and pain and confusion, anger and jealousy, and so on.
That's correct. They're both complements. Service and meditation are complement to each other. One helps the other. With service, our nature becomes more harmonious, giving us more energy for meditation. And meditation gives us greater depth and understanding that we can apply in service.
Well, that's excellent. I see, Juarez, that we're just about out of time. I've really enjoyed having you on the show, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to come back again in the future and speak to another topic.
It'll be a great pleasure to come back and talk about any other subject that we mutually decide that might help others also.
All right. And is there any final thought on the creation of the meditative mind or on a life of spiritual practice that you would like to leave our listeners with as you sum up?
Well, I just add that this century we're seeing a tremendous what the esoteric books call radiatory activity, and the whole planet is being drawn into a life of higher spirituality, and we're going to see great teachers of meditation, esoteric knowledge appear everywhere in this world. And this is a great time to be living in and to be learning and to be expanding our inner life and and contributing to the world.
How can people access these emerging spiritual teachers? How can they find them? Let's say a person does not live in a very large city or doesn't know anyone who's practicing meditation. How can they draw such a person into their own life and circle and circumstances?
You know, my own experience and observation is that the ancient adage that when the people is ready, teacher will arrive, it works very, very, really, very truthfully and very actually in our lives. And as soon as one truly starts seeking, usually a vibratory activity in the body is set up, which somehow attunes or brings the appropriate teacher into their life. I mean, they can start looking, you know, read books, look on the internet, but somehow they will stumble on just the right person coming into their life and guiding them.
Would you say that the magnetism in the heart, the desire of the heart, actually attracts to them the perfect individual for their particular level of understanding and capacity?
Yes, that would be a very good way of putting it.
And would you say that that's actually corresponding to the law of attraction as mentioned in the film The Secret?
That's just right, because it's not just teachers. Whatever you're looking, whatever you're seeking, whatever magnetic vibratory force that is set up in the heart, in one's causal self, will bring whatever you're seeking in your life.
Then I would think that, therefore, it's extremely important to be aware of the desires that we are harboring in the heart, their quality and their nature, and the law of unintended consequences that might result from our fervently desiring a particular situation or outcome.
That's correct. Very early in my life, I read this injunction that be careful what you desire because you're likely to get it.
And then you have to deal with it.
And then you have to deal with it.
Yes.
So why not desire that which is the highest, noblest, most conducive to happiness for one and for all others?
On that note of wisdom, I think that we'll need to close because of our time constraints. Juarez, this has been delightful, and I look forward to interviewing you again. Thank you so much for giving your time to us this evening.
Thank you, Connie, for giving me the opportunity.
You're welcome. Good night.